I wish some of you could have been with us this morning during Theology and Donuts. We had an extended, fairly hilarious conversation asking the question of what it's going to mean if pigs get to go to heaven. And what an awkward conversation, or what a series of awkward conversations that's going to turn into. May the Lord be with you. Clearly, this is the Lenten season, and you may have noticed that we are leaning heavy into Lent this season, especially today. Every year, the publishing industry makes an absolute bundle, selling books that teach us how to have a good life. There are rules for winning our best life with highly effective friends, and they tell us the secret which frees us from worry and drives us with purpose, an optimized for financial freedom life with maximum self-esteem, emotional intelligence, and unlimited power. I'm not totally making fun of that. I've read some of these books. You've read some of these books, right? The one I read not that long ago was called The War of Art. And of course, they always have to have a great after title, Break Through the Blocks and Win Your Inner Creative Battles. It's a pretty good book. It's mostly about procrastination. Human beings are full of potential, and we are also very, very good at disappointing ourselves, failing to live up to that potential. Books like these present us with a chance to unlock some of those unrealized possibilities, maybe. They encourage us to be a better version of ourselves, to live a better life. We've been doing this a really long time. If you want to go back to one of the first self-help books, a guy named Plato wrote it, called it Ethics. And it was already 400 years old by the time Jesus hit the scene. His assorted musings offered us a path to a richer, fuller, happier life by means of measured, thoughtful, virtuous practice. The well-lived life was described as a pursuit of optimized personhood, a realized self. The philosopher Albert North Whitehead famously said, "The safest general characterization of the European philosophical tradition is that it consists of a series of footnotes to Plato." So if he's right, then this landslide of self-help books are telling us anything. This idea of the optimized life is the air we breathe as a culture. It shapes our view of society, our view of ourselves. It's how we grade ourselves, our accomplishments. It's how we judge other people. It's how we measure a life of success or a life of tragedy and failure. Well, we're in a church today, and so let's ask the question, is the Bible a self-help book? Now, if you go to one of those Christian bookstores, you will find plenty of books that use snippets and chunks and pieces of the Bible to draft a sort of a self-help model. You can make actually quite a bit of money doing that. If you cherry-pick the right verse or two, you might just have a bestseller on your hands. My wife has asked me when I'm going to write one of those. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. There is an abundance of wisdom in the pages of Scripture. But other parts of the Bible, particularly the words of Jesus, they seem so strange and difficult to us, don't they? The gospel of Jesus doesn't seem to fit our model for the optimum life. In many ways, it seems to contradict it, almost as though Jesus' aims for the world don't really match up with our own aims. Like this one, in the King James even, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone, but if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit." When I was a younger man, reading Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov for the first time, I was really puzzled by the fact that he used this verse to frame the whole book, and actually a plan for a whole trilogy of books. I mean, if you're going to choose a thematic verse, at least give me something with some pop, with some pep. This image of death seemed to me to be needlessly dark, masochistic even. The optimized life part of me totally resisted this. How am I supposed to follow a path and live like this? Is this good for anyone? John chapter 12 takes us into Jesus' final week, the last long days leading to Jerusalem. As he grows in popularity with the crowds, the authorities hate him all the more because he is upsetting the religious system, the optimized system. And these frustrated religious gatekeepers are running out of ideas, and they're just angry. And you can hear it in their voices when they finally throw their hands up in the air and they say to one another, "You see, you can do nothing. The world has gone after him." And right on cue, driving home the point, the very next verse, totally not an accident, the world shows up. Well, some Greeks show up, and for John, they stand in for the whole world, the civilized world, Plato's world, the reasoned, thoughtful, philosophically minded world. Give us democracy, for crying out loud. These Greeks are compelled by this amazing teacher. Now, some of those went up to the worship at the festival were some Greeks. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and said to him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Well, John actually doesn't tell us if they actually get to meet Jesus or not. And this sermon, he doesn't actually address the Greeks in any real way. But their arrival seems to wake something in him. A reminder for a moment of the mammoth scope and reach of his work in the days ahead. The itinerant prophet from Nazareth is not just a local phenomenon, not just a local teacher or life coach, because the Son of Man knows his purpose. How strange it must have been for the disciples and those crowds and those Greeks, expecting some sort of great teachings or life lessons, some notes they could take or a theme they could use for an optimal life, maybe. And then Jesus says stuff like this: "And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." Jesus' second to last public sermon is loaded with difficult sayings like this, these mysterious analogies and dark allusions to the coming days. And one of these penetrating images is this picture of a seed dying in the earth and bringing new life. Seeds are pretty amazing. A few weeks ago, Amanda called me. She had me on the phone, and there was a giggle in her voice, and she said to me, "What do you want to grow in the corner of my garden that you're going to use this year?" You see, she's one of those people that treats the arrival of the West Coast seed catalog like a sort of Christmas morning, Halloween, and Boxing Day all rolled into one. Do we have any other people like that in here? Yes? No? She gets a little silly, and Troy, am I right? She spends a little more than she, yes, yeah. It's hard not to get carried away with the West Coast seed catalog. And why not? Seeds are amazing. They're beautiful. In our gardens, even in frosty Edmonton, whatever zone this is, we have an amazing assortment of plants we can grow, all sorts of shapes and sizes. I even put a picture of a seed diagram on the bulletin this week. Seeds are the captured nugget of potential, encapsulated in that tough little shell, protecting starch, and germ, nutrients, the source code of life, a little embryo of a dandelion or a pumpkin vine or a sequoia. A seed is simply a marvel of creation. And without seeds, we don't have much to call life on this planet. The scientists who built the Svalbard seed vault, has anyone heard of that? It's a bunker that was cut into the side of a mountain on a remote island in the Norwegian Arctic. The seed vault is a long-term protection for one of the most important resources on Earth. They have almost 1 million seeds and room for 5 million seeds. For the Son of Man, the living sign of God's boundless love and engagement and connection with the world and its inhabitants, for the Son of Man, whose whole life and work has been ripe with purpose and mission, when that life, when that seed is poured out for the world, when that seed of life gives himself to the earth, this is the stuff of our salvation. This is the good news of the gospel. The suffering and brutality of the passion story, this path to glory on a Roman cross, is troubling. Even Jesus says it in this very sermon, "My soul is troubled." But if we consider our world and its long and tortured history, and the news cycle that we even live in today, could the God who comes and lives among us, the God who gives himself to us, the God who knows us and lives in the human story, would there be a way? Could there be a way for him to die that didn't include violence and betrayal, unjust treatment and scorn? Can you know the human condition in all its fullness if you don't know the dark parts of it? The God who suffers truly is God with us. But he doesn't stop here. Jesus doesn't use this image in the ground to talk about himself and his own struggle only. This isn't just a sermon about Jesus. This is a sermon about following Jesus too. In the next verses, he calls us to a way of living, a way of being in the world that irritates and challenges all of our notions of the optimized life. Because what he calls us to goes against all of our instincts and all of our natural reactions. Those who love their life will lose it, and those who hate their life in this world will keep it. If our life is a precious seed, it does make sense that we are hardwired to hold on to it with such tenacity. We see and feel all of that potential that we have been given all of this life. And there's a part of us, the self-preservation part, the protect what you know and love bit of us, it just doesn't want to let go. The call to live this Jesus way is so radical, it seems foreign and alien to us. And yet, for many of us, deep in our hearts, we have come to know that there is strange truth in this Jesus call. We know that one of the tragic ironies of life is that hoarding and self-interest and the pursuit of this optimum life can so quickly turn rancid and toxic on us. Think for a second. How much self-destructive behavior do we put ourselves through? How many wasted lives have we seen? People trying to hold on to the last shreds of things that no one has ever been able to hold on to. Attempts at the optimum life that were really an ongoing effort to master forces that we have no control over whatsoever. How many industries thrive on this anxiety, on these illusions? Is it youth we want to keep? Beauty? Our money? Our power? Our virility? Comfort? Our security? Convenience? Why is it that people who seem to have everything so often suffer from such acute despair? One of my favorite podcasts, the Liturgist podcast, said it like this: rich in power for powerful people who were told they own the world. Well, they got it, and too often, it tastes like ashes. People realizing that the bill of goods they were sold by the world was fraudulent. They were told what success was, but it was a lie. And we know this deep in our hearts. Unless you're a goth, for the most part, humans don't like thinking about their own mortality. Despite the fact that everybody, all of us, are going to die eventually, we really don't like to think about that reality. We should be grateful then for this season when the architects of the church calendar have written it into the liturgy. They've given us a moment to remind us of this very fact, and they actually rub it in with ashes. Remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Like every other organism on this planet, we get an unknown span of days to live and explore, to work and love and grow and follow this Jesus into the world. We are called to germinate, to let the water in, to open up our brittle little defenses. We're called to expose that precious store of energy that we have been given to the world. We've been made to snuggle in to the earth, mingling our precious resources and shared nutrients with creation. Germ and starch mixed in with the earthy minerals and mulch of our place, our people, our history, and our habitat. Is this a death? Should we mourn the seed when it is planted? Is this a day when a seed yields to the soil that we need to be grieved by? Is this risky and difficult way a terrible waste of a life? Well, it is a death of sorts. What dies is our illusion of safety, security, isolation, self-sufficiency. Our independence, our stubborn selfishness, that dies too. This Jesus life puts to death the illusion that somehow we are the master of some sort of optimized personal journey, because we, too, are giving our lives to the world. And there we find true purpose, because Christ lives in us. A seed that finds purchase in the earth is finally alive, awake to the air and the soil and the metabolizing nutrients and life-giving light, stretching out at first little tentative roots, pushing out buds of hope. Who knows what varieties of crops we have sown? Do you feel like your resources are too small and you're just too little? Fair enough. Remember that a blade of grass doesn't worry itself about covering an entire field. God bless the grass that grows through the crack. Who can say what shape your growth will take, what it will look like? You might be like a garden that feeds a family for a season, or an oak tree that shades 1,000 picnics under its branches. Maybe you're an heirloom crop that reminds us what something wild tastes like. The seed of your life, this gift from your Creator, this vital step in the cycle of life, this is what you have to give the world. This is what following Jesus looks like. Sometimes seeds twirl down to the earth with little helicopter wings, or they float on the wind like fluffy little paratroopers. Lodgepole pine cones keep their precious seed cargo locked up so tight they only open when the forest burns. Some seeds get where they're going thanks to the feeding habits, the hardy bowels, and the scattered excrement of animals like birds and hippos and Buffalo. Where have you been? How far have you come? From what height have you fallen? What have you been through? Where do you find yourself right now? This Jesus life does not guarantee your safety. It may well take you to hard places. You will have to let go of so many illusions and entanglements, but this is how God loves the world, through you. This is how Jesus saves the world. This fruitful life of the seed is how we truly live. Thanks be to God.